Hello and welcome to Democracy In, hosted by me, Mary Layton. In this podcast, we explore the good, the bad, and the frankly weird side of different democratic systems around the world. Today we're going to be hearing about democracy in Chile from my two guests, Rodrigo Retamal and Paloma Contreras. Our conversation will be divided into two podcast episodes, so make sure you listen to the second half. And be sure to visit the website, www.democracyinpodcast.com. There you will find more information about the topics discussed today, as well as updates on which country I'll be visiting next. Now, before we dive into this conversation, I should probably explain that I spent a year and a half living in Chile between 2010 and 2011. I was there doing research for my PhD dissertation, and that's where I met Rodrigo, who you're going to be hearing from today. So, of all the countries we're covering in this podcast series, apart from my own country, the UK, Chile is probably the one I know the best in terms of the history of its democracy. As a result, I realized only later when I was editing the audio that my guests and I never properly explained some of the important facts, particularly about the dictatorship, that you're going to need to know in order to understand some of what we're talking about. We mentioned things like the dictatorship a lot, especially in this first episode, but it's quite likely many of you listening don't even know when that was, so I'm going to give you some basics that you should probably know before we start. So, Chile was colonized by the Spanish back in the 16th century and became independent in around, I think it was 1810. However, the indigenous groups living in the south, particularly the Mapuche, never really stopped fighting for their land and freedom, and that's quite relevant. Although they're officially Chilean, the Mapuche and the other indigenous peoples who live in other parts of the country have long been discriminated against and oppressed. Like its neighbour, Argentina, Chile has seen multiple waves of European immigration over the centuries, particularly during the 20th century, and considers itself more Europeanised than indigenous, and those are both in inverted commas, of course. As a result, it's not that unusual, I discovered when I lived there, to find blonde, blue-eyed Chileans with Polish, Scottish, or Swedish last names, particularly in the capital city of Santiago. As Rodrigo is going to tell us in this conversation, race, indigeneity, and colonialism are still very relevant to any debate about citizenship and democracy in Chile today. For most of the 20th century, Chile was actually considered to be an unusually strong democracy, particularly when compared to other countries in the region. So when the US-backed military coup occurred on September the 11th, 1973, it was truly shocking. It was as unbelievable as a sudden military overthrow of the UK government today would be. The coup overthrew the democratically elected government of Salvador Allende, who died by suicide in the presidential palace rather than be taken prisoner. And this was the beginning of an incredibly violent right-wing dictatorship headed by General Pinochet. Over the next 18 years of the dictatorship, 200,000 Chileans fled or were driven into exile, an estimated 30,000 people were killed or tortured, and the total number of people who were forcibly disappeared will never probably be known. Democracy returned to Chile in 1990. And it was at this point that a new national constitution that General Pinochet had drafted 10 years before came into effect. So, for the last 32 years, Chilean democracy has been operating according to the laws of its violent right-wing dictator, a man who died peacefully of natural causes in 2006, thanks to the British government. That's another story. All of this is to say, it's not always easy to say that in Chile, authoritarianism was unequivocally overthrown by liberal democracy. And with that in mind, let's begin. Okay. Right. So welcome, guys. I'm really, really excited to have you guys here. Why don't we start by having you introduce yourself? Paloma, do you want to go first? Tell us a bit about you.
Of course. First of all, thank you for having me. My name is Paloma. I am a PhD student at the University of Michigan. Mm-hmm. I'm originally from Santiago, from Chile. Mm-hmm. And I spent most of my life in the southwest area of Santiago. Mm-hmm. But I've been here in the US for 5 years.
5 years, yeah. And you work on the same water project that David works on, who was part of the Mexico podcast on the last episode. So thank you. Rodrigo, do you want to introduce yourself?
Thank you for the invitation. I'm Chilean too. So yeah, I'm living in Santiago too. I'm a lecturer at the University of Chile at the Department of Anthropology. My racial background is Hispanic, let's say, but you know, in Chile, it means something like a mixture of different backgrounds, like indigenous for one part. My grandparents come, well, one of them come from Lebanon. So
From Lebanon,
some
right?
yes. So it's something very, very mixture.
Great. And you are both physical anthropologists, which
Yeah, that's something
is something
we
that,
forgot.
yeah, that connects you both. And Rodrigo, you lived in a different country as well, didn't you?
Yes. I did my PhD in UK in the University of Cambridge. I spent like 5 years or 4 years and a half there.
Okay, so we should start by talking about the big issue, it seems to me, in Chile right now,
Yes.
about this referendum you guys had on the Constitution. So, would one of you like to start by trying to explain it in a simple way? Like, how do you explain what's just happened?
Okay, so maybe I can start and then you can add all the things that I will miss. So this referendum was meant to be a way to approve or not approve a new constitution in our country. And this comes as a the result of a social movement that started in 2019. We called it like an explosion,
Oh,
right?
wow.
Like a social uprising that stopped the country for many months. And as a solution for that, politicians agreed to reconsider the possibility of writing a new constitution and change the one that we have, that is the one we inherited from the dictatorship.
And this isn't the first time the Constitution has been rewritten, right? It's not like in the US where they had the same one since the beginning of the country started.
Yes, the Chilean Constitution was made in the 1980s
Okay, so this one was in the
during
80s.
the Pinochet dictatorship, and we have had like three in total, three constitutions in Chile. So this is the last one. That one was made on 1980s, was the third constitution. But the thing is, it was made under a dictatorship, and it's a very neoliberal way of politics. So the Chilean people would like to change many things, items, or topics in the constitution.
You know, from the outside, it can feel a bit like a constitution is like, why does that impact you every day? It's just like a piece of paper, right? But what is the push to change it? Why was it so important that it was from the dictatorship, for instance?
So I think it's, first of all, the symbolic power of having something that is from the dictatorship, and now the opportunity to change it for one that was not only democratic, but also had gender as important factor, included indigenous communities, and it was also including working class people for the first time. So I think it's mostly symbolic. Like, even if you don't talk about what is written in the new proposal of a constitution, it was still very important, in symbolic terms.
It also the old constitution, well, the constitution from 1980s has a problem that if the people wants to make some changes in legal terms, they couldn't make it because many of these proposals are considered unconstitutional.
Oh, I see.
That's the problem. And the structure of the constitution has a very weird organization, because we have a constitutional tribune. When you have a proposal, even accepted by the Congress, even after being approved, they had to pass by this Constitutional Tribune.
Okay.
And this Constitutional Tribune is like four people that they review the proposal and see if the constitution, see if the proposal fits with the constitution. So many, many, like, I don't know, from this last decade, kind of 8 or 9 different proposals have been rejected by this Constitutional Tribune. So that's something very weird.
This is
something that was created precisely in terms of trying to impede, to stop
progress.
Yes, yeah. like Paloma say, like, for example, abortion. Mm-hmm. Indigenous rights, etc.
Okay, I see. So it's kind of like when the last constitution was written, it was like, okay, we're going to put something in place to guarantee that nothing will actually change. You might get rid of the dictatorship and you might have a democracy now, but everything has to stick to the rules that were written by the dictator.
Exactly. That's the thing. It's very rigid. Constitution.
So those four people who are in the tribune, how are they appointed or elected? Where do they come from?
I don't remember well.
No? Okay.
But it's not democratic at
all. Yeah. Paloma, I'm wondering if it's is it similar to the Supreme Court? Is it that kind of situation?
Yes. I think it's the same role.
Okay.
I'm not sure how the members of the tribune are elected, but I believe maybe they're chosen by Congress.
Okay.
But I'm not sure.
So maybe it's not quite as prominent as it is in the US, where everyone knows who the Supreme Court people are. It's just these mysterious people.
Yes.
Yeah, I think it's not about the individuals that are there. It's just like the institution.
Right. So wasn't the push to get a new constitution also part of a plebiscite, a part of a referendum?
Yes, it was a plebiscite.
Okay. But then it was rejected.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. So we first approved the idea of changing the constitution. The new proposal was written, and then we rejected that proposal.
I can see, Rodrigo, you're trying to look up now how the... Don't worry. It's fine.
Yeah. Sorry.
The thing is, I think to me, the thing that's interesting is that you don't necessarily know. So it's different from the US one, right? Where everyone knows who all the Supreme Court people are, and it's very, very controversial. But it's instead this mysterious thing. Yeah. So what's going to happen now, do you think, now that the thing has been rejected?
The things are very blurred now.
Okay. Yeah.
Because after the rejection of this new constitution, the political parties now are just talking and they are trying to make some agreement. But the right side, after this tremendous disapproval of the new constitution, they really don't want to make any change to the old constitution.
Yeah.
And the thing is, it's like the right side, they say that they want to reform or to create another new and renewed constitution.
Yeah.
But now many of them are saying that they don't want to make any change.
They don't want to make any change at all. Okay. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's the problem. The right wing always said, no, we don't want to change things. Then when we voted that we wanted a new constitution, they said, okay, we're going to be part of this process and we want to participate and contribute to this new constitution.
Yeah.
And then when we had to vote if we approve or not this proposal, they, of course, supported the rejection of this new proposal.
Right. That sounds,
we don't want to change. But then it's like, okay, fine, we can change a few things. And then it's like, no, we don't want to change anything.
So that's kind of sneaky. Yeah.
In their campaigns, they said, yeah, we want to change things, but not this way.
Right.
We want to do it seriously. We want to use other institutions. And now, so they promised people that changes were going to be made.
Yeah.
But now they're saying well, maybe this is a process that can take 50, 100 years.
Right. Yeah.
That's horrible. Yeah.
Right. So they're just demonstrating that they've been trying to just block this process and keep things as they are for as long as possible.
Yeah. I remember when I, you know, I haven't been in Chile since 2011, I think. And I remember at the time, Rodrigo, it may have been you who told me about this, that after the dictatorship ended, it was still extremely popular with a large portion of the population. And it,
absolutely,
yeah,
yes.
It often felt to me like the way people talked about the post-democracy period in Chile, that you still have this weird, like, half the population still thinks the dictatorship was fine. Is that still
absolutely.
Is that still the case? Is that what we're seeing with this debate?
Yeah, Chile is very conservative.
Yeah.
And the dictatorship was just another step to this very conservative way of make politics. We had to even go, I don't know, in the 1830s, there was the first dictatorship created by Diego Portales.
Okay.
And he was the first person who made the constitution, like a constitution that really rules the country. And that constitution was like the cornerstone of a very conservative and very military country.
Interesting, yeah.
So we have to understand that the Chilean people, we have to also understand that we were a colony. Mm. So the differences between like high class and low class was very strong in past. And even nowadays, the socioeconomic strata is very, 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 they define the people.
Yeah.
And people from low class, they feel that they have to follow a leader.
Interesting.
From my point of view,
yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah.
We can debate about it.
Yeah.
But many of them. So I think that's the debate that we create this kind of new processes in which there's some people in low and middle class that they really want to change this point of view, this perspective, in which Chilean people have to make their own rules. They want to like being more independent to the high class, etc.
Right.
But we understand that there's many people that are very afraid of, well, the dictatorship, that it was very traumatic for many of them.
Yes.
And because it was very violent and many people, old people, they lived and they remember that experience very traumatic. So they prefer to not make many changes because... I don't know. They don't want to create a very different country.
Interesting. Yeah.
Something like that. Mm. And this constitution, the new constitution, the new proposal of constitution, really it was very, very revolutionary in terms of making many, many changes with many rights, different rights, like a plurinationality, like integration of indigenous communities, giving them some authority to rule their own territory, in which, like I tell you, because we are we're a colony, the indigenous people always there were treated like a very, very low class, and they were not right to any authority on their land.
Exactly. Yeah. That's really interesting. And I find it interesting that you bring it back to the colonial context, which of course is incredibly important and still has this lasting impact. But also the idea that any enormous change is going to feel traumatic, even if it's a change for the better. If your experience of big revolutionary changes led to violence in the past.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I also have to mention, I think, that so we had this new constitution after a very long and for many people traumatic pandemic.
Yes.
Inflation is crazy in Chile, and we're not used to it. Like we used to have a very stable currency, and now we don't. So it feels like all these changes started right after this social uprising. So people, of course, want to go back to normal, right? They want to just have their jobs, live their lives. They want to be able to pay bills. We also have this new migration crisis that is affecting South America in general.
I haven't heard about that, so.
Yeah, so for Chile, it's quite new. Probably when you were there, you noticed that there's not a lot of diversity in terms of nationality.
I noticed that people have it in for Peruvians. Like, I lived in a neighborhood in Santiago, and everyone would say to me, like, oh, watch out, there are Peruvians there. And I'm like, what? What's wrong? I used to live in Peru, too. What's up with this? But yeah, anyway. So,
yeah, so we used to have many migrants from Peru and Bolivia, but now we have from many other countries and people that have cultures that are very different from the Chilean one. So that's also causing, like, a maybe is invigorating the conservative side of society.
So the new immigration is from outside of South America or from different parts of South America?
Different parts of South America mostly.
Interesting.
And well, it's mostly Venezuelan, Colombian, and people from Haiti.
Right, right.
And yeah, I think maybe a few Dominicans. But these are cultures that we're not used to see on the streets. We don't really, in the past, we didn't hear any accents different than ours.
Yeah,
So it feels really new and people feel threatened by it. And and it makes sense. Of course, I'm not justifying it, but it makes sense that people are so scared. Yeah. I also want to say that I don't think I agree with Rodrigo when he says that
that is fine.
A conservative country. I think, like, we're like a small town. It is a small country.
Yeah.
And I think that we don't have experience because we're just a small town. You know, like, we don't understand how the big world works because we're just like this very self-centered country. And considering that 49 years ago, we had this coup d'etat and the dictatorship started. I mean, it was 49 years ago.
Yeah.
It impacted most of the population that is alive today, have that trauma or grew up hearing about that trauma.
Yeah.
So I think that even though Chile is institutionally, I think, is very conservative, I think in society in general, we are not that conservative. I think that in other countries, it's the opposite. Institutionally, they're super progressive, but then as a culture, they're not. I believe in Chile, it's the opposite. Institutions are more conservative and the culture. So, for example, when you see cases such as abortion rights or women's rights or the protection of the environment and things like that, I will say that you get the majority supporting those causes. But in terms of laws and what the government is doing, it's definitely not something that is relevant for them.
That is super interesting. That's super interesting. And maybe it's partly because they can't change things because the constitution is still stuck. So even if you want to do progressive things, you can't. But I wonder if this also comes back to who gets to be in, like, a politician, who gets to be in charge. I'm assuming a small group of people tend to represent most of the powerful people in the country.
Yeah, it's, again, like a small town. You know the last names of the people that are in power. You know what schools they go to.
Right.
They're all private schools. They're all for rich people. They're the ones that have the opportunity to be in these roles. And also, I think the influence that rich people have in the media in Chile is very important.
Right.
I was listening to the previous episode on Mexico, and I remember David mentioned that, can you have a democracy where people cannot communicate different opinions? And I think that even though we don't have the same level of violence as in Mexico, we definitely have less diversity in what ideas are communicated in the media, because all these television channels are owned by private companies or
yeah.
religious institutions. So that influence is huge.
Yeah, yeah. So it's not like a violent control of all of those institutions. It's more like just a money control, right? It's a quieter, but still just as powerful way of keeping all the power just in a few people's hands. Yeah. Okay, well, let's, before we get too far into this, let's talk about like what is the basic organization so we all know what we're talking about. So you have a president, right?
Exactly.
Yes, yeah. And does the president actually have a lot of power?
Yes, yes. Yeah, the president here has a lot of power. It's part of our history. We have had many political trials, and one of them was in past the Congress had more power, in the 19th century, but okay. After a civil war,
uh-huh.
The president became the most powerful person in the government.
And there's nobody above the president, just the constitution, right. I guess. Yeah, yeah.
The president. And the executive power can give some proposal to the mm-hmm. Congress, mm-hmm. and the Congress can accept or not this mm-hmm. proposal. But many of them are has a very strong influence by the president. So when the president make this proposal, it's very common mm-hmm. that they will be approved.
Okay, yeah, but people in their own party, I assume, just approve it.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Anyway, it's important that the Congress has a equilibrium of power. So mm-hmm. when the Congress has a more has the majority,
yeah.
They have many opportunities to approve these proposals.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. So then under the president, you have Congress. Is there two chambers? Is it that kind
exactly.
of system?
Exactly. We have two chambers.
Okay. I'm finding it super interesting that it seems like most of the Americas have this similar system, like president with two chambers. Mm. And I've started to look at some other places like in Europe, and it seems many of them are more like the parliament system. So this is something I'm kind of getting interested in. Yeah. So you got the two chambers. And how many political parties are there?
Now there's many political parties.
Oh,
I
yeah?
don't remember how many, but in past we had a very similar system like the states.
Yeah.
Like a more left side and more right yeah. side coalitions.
Yeah.
But now, they constitute coalitions among them. So it was always just passing the power from this party to another party. And then it was a ping pong, a table tennis mm-hmm. Game.
Yep.
Right, left. After the dictatorship,
yep.
there was I don't remember, three or four left governments. But mm-hmm. after that, mm-hmm. there was table tennis
yeah.
change. But now, I think there are kind of 10 different parties.
Oh,
I don't know. I
would say more.
I think more.
We
yes,
have 50. But 50?
Oh wow.
I don't think it's that relevant. In terms of how you vote for things, because finally you just have three groups. In the past,
okay.
you had two groups.
Exactly.
And by in the past, I mean before maybe 2019. But in recent years, there's a third group that is gaining more space and more power. And mm-hmm. I will say that if you had the same model as in the US, you have Republicans, mm-hmm. Democrats, this third
yeah.
group will be liberals.
Mm-hmm. All right.
So it's a far left. It's not far left. It's just left.
more left than the neoliberal left. Yes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Most of them are individuals that were leading social movements in 2011, in 2006.
Yeah.
So they
yeah.
come from that experience of doing politics as a student mm-hmm. in universities,
yes.
in schools,
yes.
in high schools. So lots of people that have been on the streets protesting and now are in power.
Yeah. And I want to come back to that in a minute because I think that's super interesting because it's so different from the US. Mm. This whole idea of, well, all the high school students and students who are super involved in politics
exactly.
Over the last decade or so. But okay, so you said that around 2019, there was a shift if it had previously been two political parties and suddenly you have like 50, what happened to change that?
Well, it isn't that you had, so in the past you had like 10 different political parties, but they were grouped in these two coalitions.
Oh,
it didn't matter that much if you were like from the Socialist Party or like a radical party. People will still vote for more or less the same things. And when you go and vote for a president, you're really thinking, am I supporting the conservative or the left?
Right. Okay.
And that's it.
So when you vote, are there two rounds? Is that how it works?
Yes.
So you can work for like, you could vote for like, I don't know, the Marxist party or whatever you want to, and then the next round vote for the liberal person who's probably going to win.
Exactly. When there are president elections, if only if one candidate obtained more than 50%, they immediately win the election. But normally
in the first round.
But normally it's impossible. So normally they pass to the second round, the first two candidates.
And in terms of coalition politics, does the fact it's a coalition rather than one party actually mean that they have to take into account the different opinions of different people in the coalition? Does it lead to more of a range of different points of view?
Yes, there's many arrangements of point of view between them, among them.
Okay.
It's like, I don't know, nowadays, for example, the political party that rules, the coalition that rules the country, it also has included the Communist Party, for instance.
Right. Interesting. Yeah.
So it is a very big range, large range of perspectives, like a very social and more progressive a point of view. So they have to negotiate between them, among them, the different ministries, the different, I don't know, politics in general, like what to do, how to do it, etc. And the same thing, it happens in the more right coalition, in which there are very far right point of views.
Yeah.
And all the more liberal.
Yeah, yeah. That is kind of fascinating to me because from my perspective, that seems really different from places where they just have two parties.
Mm.
Like Paloma, I'm wondering how it seems to you being in the US and seeing, for instance, like the Republican Party is incredibly monolithic now. They're just like, they have one line, they're told what to do and they all do the same thing. But it sounds like it's much more dynamic and much more negotiation if you have a coalition.
Yeah, I think that definitely you have more space for fighting for power, maybe, once you are part of the government. Each party is going to care a lot about how many of the ministers are from your party. So, for example, if you have 20 different positions, the Communist Party will say, okay, so I supported your campaign. I should get at least two of those seats, or three, or five, depending on how strong that party is in the moment. And that's something that we're seeing now, because even though we chose this president that comes from this third group that is more liberal and progressive, even though we chose him, now he is giving power or assigning some of those seats to the people in traditional political parties from the equivalent of the Democrats, right? So it feels like in the US, I feel like you are trapped, right? You have two options. You don't get those.
You're stuck. Yes.
There's nothing you can do. It's just two options.
Yeah.
And that's it. Well, in Chile, we voted for a third option. And I think that took a lot of work. And a lot of political activism for decades. But even though we have now this third option, because the right wing is pressuring so much, they're giving space to the more traditional Democratic group.
How do people feel about that? Because if it's like you describe, people are so reluctant to change, and then this big change happens. Okay, we got this third group, but then they still have to stay in power, which is kind of what you'd expect, right? It's kind of obvious. Like, of course, you still have to pay attention to the people who've been there forever. But then, how do people react to that?
I think it depends on who you ask. I would say for all these questions about like what people think, I would say
Yeah.
I have no idea
No,
because
that's fine.
after the referendum and seeing that the rejecting new proposal of the constitution was so popular, they got 68% of the vote, I think.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And I think that for us, probably Rodrigo also thinks feels this way. For us that come from like an intellectual group of people that have access to education and maybe resources to read more and study more and like a comfortable lifestyle, we thought that the constitution was what Chile wanted, and now we learn that that's not it, but we don't know what it is. No one knows what it is. So everyone is fighting each other and trying to understand what people are thinking. Do they want to change? What type of change? Is it about when or who or why? What is it? We have no idea.
So it took you by surprise.
So when you wonder what people think of our current government incorporating more traditional politicians in power, I think that many people are desilusionados, like disappointed,
Disappointed.
because we were trying to see this new group, this third group, bringing young people, very qualified, with gender and environment and indigenous groups as a priority. And now they're bringing back these old politicians, that ignored those claims for more than 30 years. So it's very disappointing, but maybe for some people, it gives them more stability or like a perception of stability that they need, especially considering that the situation nowadays is very difficult for lots of
Yeah,
people.
no, that's super interesting.
That's why I think the Chilean people are still very conservative because there were many impressive changes, like so many different changes that the new constitution proposes. That people, I think they were not very clear about what these changes can be like understood by them. For instance, well, we have a kind of racist. I don't know if we are so racist like the people say about the US, but we have how I told you, like a colonialist perspective, make that the people, like the indigenous people, considered like in low class,
Lower
so
class,
in a lower class. So this kind of idea of plurinationality sound very weird for many people. For instance, or the women rights or other genders rights. That was very confusing and strange, but because the people who, many of them after the upheaval, the social movement in
2019.
2019, they want like a more right for housing, wage, I don't know, more shallow, let's say, I don't know if more shallow, but look more day by day things. But
They
this
want
kind
more
of things are
direct
very, very
changes.
ideological change of thought that come from like in a more intellectual part of the people, more progressive way of thinking. And I think the left side and the progressive parties, they couldn't teach and show the importance of these kind of changes. And even the environment changes, that they are very urgent in Chile, they were not really approved by the same people that live in places that now are at risk of environmental crisis, etc. So I don't know. There's something very strange. I think there's many other factors. Of course, the right side, for instance, they spend a lot of money in social media and social
Spreading
network,
lies.
spread
Spreading
lies,
lies.
exactly.
Okay, so we're going to take a break here, but look out for the second half of this conversation, where we'll be talking about a democratic revolution led by 13-year-olds that transformed Chilean society completely. If you enjoyed this podcast, you can subscribe, share, or even support us by going to the website www.democracyinpodcast.com. There you'll find more information about the topics discussed today, as well as updates on which countries I will be visiting next.